From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Happy Martin Luther King Day. Today's also the one-year anniversary of the historic nuclear deal the U.S. and five key allies struck with Iran. Supporters say it keeps Iran's nuclear program under tight restrictions for at least a decade. But members of the incoming Trump administration have vowed to scrap it. Yesterday, Trump's chief of staff, Reince Priebus, told ABC the jury's still out, but
we all know that President-elect Trump doesn't like the Iran deal. Thinks it's a terrible document, thinks it will create a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, which it already is beginning to do.
NPR's Peter Kenyon is in Istanbul, Turkey. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Robin.
And how is the deal going a year after implementation?
Well, it is still going. The UN's nuclear agency just yesterday confirmed that Iran had met another obligation. It removed nearly two-thirds of the centrifuges, the uranium spinning machines, from the Fordo underground enrichment site, which will now not be an enrichment site, but a research facility. From Tehran, we've been hearing from a senior Iraqi negotiator. His name is Abbas Araghchi. He was talking to reporters in Tehran about how the deal looked from their perspective after a year. Here's an excerpt.
ما در طول یک سال گذشته با بدعهدی ها
Now, he's basically saying Iran did achieve some successes. The economy's improving after years of sanctions, but that was in spite of America. Araghchi says, in the past year, we've encountered broken promises, delaying tactics, antagonistic policies. He says the negative behavior by Washington was expected and would be overcome. But then he also said this agreement would not be renegotiated, which could prove significant.
Well, yeah, because as we're hearing, the Trump administration might want to do that. But so you're saying that Iran seems to be living up to its commitments, but there are some controversies. What are they?
Well, Iran agreed to some really tight limits on its nuclear program, but it's pushing up against those limits pretty aggressively in a couple of areas. Its stockpile of heavy water is one. Low-enriched uranium fuel is another. Now, the deal's got enforcement mechanisms, and they've basically caught the problems, and they're being corrected. But it does show Tehran is determined to hang on to every bit of the nuclear program that the deal does allow. And because these stockpiles go up and down over time, you know, if they get real close to the limits, they can sometimes go over.
Yeah. Well, so talk about the deal and perhaps there being a push to either renegotiate it or drop it. What is the sense of how possible that is?
Well, at the moment, Iran's keeping a pretty tough lineup in its public comments, saying this is multilateral. It's got the UN Security Council behind it. You can't just scrap it. But if you look at the change that's going on in Washington, the prospects for this deal seeing a second anniversary could be in question. Trump calls it the dumbest deal he's ever seen in his latest interview. In the past, he's talked about making it stronger. I checked with Iran analyst Ali Vaez. He's with the International Crisis Group. And he says they're going to be a bit careful on both sides. Neither Iran nor the U.S. really want to be blamed for killing the deal, but it could still happen quite easily because there's so much political hostility between the two countries. Here's how he put it.
This doesn't mean we can't get into a destructive tit-for-tat where we will be in a gray zone in which it's not clear who has really violated the agreement. And I think this is the biggest threat to the deal, that it could become collateral damage of this game of rivalry that has played out between Iran and the United States over the past three decades.
Well, that's pretty gloomy.
certainly is.
Yeah. Do you see any bright spots?
Well, this same group, the International Crisis Group, came out with a report today looking back at the first year and looking ahead. And it makes the point that Donald Trump will be the first president in some two decades to take office without having to worry that Iran is just around the corner from getting a nuclear weapon. Analyst Ali Vaez told me it's conceivable that once Trump takes office and realizes that his shelves are groaning with other crises that need attention, maybe he won't rush to undo the nuclear deal and possibly reignite that crisis.
Well, meanwhile, a part of the deal is allowing business with Iran. How's that going? I mean, are there U.S. companies that might be saying, well, wait a second, you started us down a path we don't want to stop?
Well, some may be saying that, but there's more saying we don't quite see our way through this path yet. There are still sanctions in place that have to do with other things, non-nuclear related, the human rights record, some very legitimate concerns. But it's making risk analysts at some of these corporations very leery of going ahead with even the deals that this nuclear agreement allows because of concerns about it falling apart. And there's a thing called a snapback provision where all of the sanctions instantly come back into place. So there's a lot of problems for Iran trying to get these deals done. But they have done some. They just got their first Airbus. They've had some oil deals, and they do expect some more.
NPR's Peter Kenyon from Istanbul, Turkey, and talking about the latest on the Iran nuclear deal, the one-year anniversary of that deal today. Peter, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, as this country marks Martin Luther King Day today, it's worth noting that this year also marks 50 years since a Supreme Court case fully legalized interracial marriage in the United States. That was Loving versus Virginia. But even after that decision, interracial couples that wanted to marry still faced resistance and even threats, especially in the South. Mary Helen Montgomery from Here and Now contributor WPLN met an interracial couple in Chattanooga, Tennessee, one of the first to marry legally.
The first time Gloria Griffith laid eyes on Leroy Griffith, she thought he was off limits. She's black, he's white, and it was the 1960s in Tennessee. Gloria didn't think she stood a chance, but it had nothing to do with race.
I had never seen a pastor with a cigarette in his mouth before.
Leroy was the pastor at Gloria's mother's church in Chattanooga, and she was quite taken.
At that time, he was surrounded by the ladies. He was young, and he had this red Corvette. Smoking, too, and a red Corvette, and all the ladies there.
A couple of years later, Gloria and Leroy met again. Gloria's sister was sick for a while, and they got to know each other during hospital visits. Eventually, they went for a walk in the park. Next, it was a movie date.
He was wearing blue. He had a blue sweater, blue shirt, and his eyes were blue.
Now, what did you wear to the movie?
Oh, to the movie, I wore a mini skirt, a blouse. I don't remember. Oh, and I had an afro.
It was the late 1960s, after all, and afros were a common sight. But an interracial couple was not, and people stared. Segregation was illegal, but society still had its own rules. Rules that Gloria and Leroy were about to challenge. A few years before, in 1965, Leroy marched from Selma to Montgomery with Martin Luther King Jr. The experience shaped him so much that he applied to be the pastor of a black Presbyterian church in Chattanooga. Gloria was an activist, too. Around the time she met Leroy, she had lost her job trying to unionize the nurses at her hospital.
You both were kind of rebels.
Where I come from, that's called soulmates. Yes, we both had a deep sense of justice and a deep sense of the dignity of what other people call the lower class and we call the human class.
After about a year of dating, Gloria agreed to marry Leroy. But her excitement was tinged by a looming reality. Marrying a white man was a huge risk. And Gloria worried that when word got out, she and her family could be hurt or worse.
I said, this is dangerous. And I said, you know, people get lynched for less than this.
She started by telling her mom the news.
She kind of said, stop playing. And I says, I'm not playing. I'm telling you the truth. And at that point, she says, do you know what kind of problems that would occur?
Her mother sent Gloria and Leroy to see Gloria's grandparents and seek their approval. And after a long discussion, her grandfather gave his blessing.
As we left the house, he raised up his hand. He was saying, this marriage is a marriage chosen by God, and I'm with you all the way.
Not everyone was supportive. Like when they tried to find a church. Leroy's church was too small, so they asked two bigger Presbyterian churches in town. Both turned them away. They decided to get married outdoors with a minister from out of town. Gloria and Leroy's engagement even offended people they didn't know.
One person called and said he was going to bomb us out. Another person said that he was going to burn us out.
But not all the calls were angry.
Then I had folk who called and asked if they could come to the wedding because they had never seen a black and white wedding and they wanted to be there when history was made.
What did you say to those people?
Bring your sons. You're welcome to come to the wedding. It was open to the public.
Everyone in town was invited. Their wedding day arrived, and to make sure there was no violence, a friend of Leroy's organized a bunch of young men to block the streets.
Their cars, quote, broke down. I don't know whether they got out and pretended they had flat tires or what they did, but they blocked the traffic.
It was a huge crowd, about 800 people, Gloria thinks.
Did you ever wish that it was just a regular wedding that people weren't paying attention to?
No. The community participated in a divine action.
Even though Gloria and Leroy stayed safe on their wedding day, they were not immune to violence. In another year and a half, race riots erupted in Chattanooga. Leroy protested in the streets, while Gloria sat at home in their predominantly white neighborhood, nursing their new baby. A brick smashed through the window. By getting married, Gloria and Leroy showed their community black and white people could coexist, even love each other. And their marriage has left a lasting impression on their city. To this day, Gloria and Leroy meet people in Chattanooga who say, "I know who you are. I was at your wedding." For Here and Now, I'm Mary Helen Montgomery.
Secretary of Education nominee Betsy DeVos will face questions on Capitol Hill tomorrow during her Senate confirmation hearing. DeVos, a billionaire philanthropist, has spent much time in Michigan working on education, and she's been a major proponent of charter schools. The success of charter schools around the country has had mixed reviews, including in DeVos's state of Michigan. But one place might offer lessons for DeVos, the education department, and other cities. That would be New Orleans. That's according to Andrew Vanacore, deputy editor at the New Orleans Advocate and author of the Politico magazine piece, What New Orleans Can Teach Betsy DeVos About Charter Schools. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. And remind us of the history here with New Orleans, because the fact that there are so many charter schools there has everything to do with Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, absolutely. There were just a small handful of charter schools before the storm. But the storm was the real catalyst, like you say. There was a state takeover of most of the schools here after the storm, and over the years they have gradually turned them over to charter groups so that now we have just a very small handful of traditional public schools, and they may actually be chartered as well soon too.
And for-profit or non-for-profit, or how are they working right now?
Every one of them is run by a non-profit board. There have been, over the years, just a couple of schools that have brought in for-profit management companies to sort of run the day-to-day at the schools, and those have typically just not worked out very well.
And you say state control. So is the state still controlling these charter schools in New Orleans?
Right. So the role played by the State Board of Education and the Department of Ed, which is headquartered in Baton Rouge, is to be the charter authorizer. So they get to say which charters open, which close, what are the standards for charters, what kind of bar are we going to hold them to. So that's the role played by state government here.
So what's happened to the charter schools and what's happened to student test scores since New Orleans went charter?
Test scores have generally sort of across the board, big picture, improved. The number of schools that are designated by the state now as officially failing has shrunk from, you know, most of the schools to just a small handful. There's still a long way to go. There's still a lot of schools that are rated a D or a C in the state's accountability system. So I don't think you could say that anybody here is kind of declaring victory. But there's been some pretty carefully studied and verified improvement in academics.
And are these things that could be repeated around the country if Betsy DeVos takes over and wants to have more charter schools in the U.S.? Are there things that she can take from what happened in New Orleans to try to replicate that success?
Yeah, that's an interesting and complicated question. The federal government doesn't make these decisions about public education. That's just the way the system in the U.S. works. You know, education policy is in the hands of state legislatures and local school boards. So the question becomes, what can, you know, a secretary of education do? What they do have power over is some pretty big purse strings. You know, the Federal Department of Education has a budget, and they can, you know, dangle some of that budget in front of districts and say, you know, if you do X, here's the grant money that you can expect to win. You know, that's something you saw during the Obama administration. There was a race to the top,
right?
Initiative is what they termed it. billions of dollars attached to these grants, and you know, the state turns in an application, and the application spells out how they're going to achieve what the federal government wants them to achieve. And a big part of that under Obama was teacher evaluations. So, you know, Louisiana now has a new teacher evaluation system, and that probably wouldn't have happened, or it may not have happened in the way that it did, but for the Race to the Top competition. Even though we didn't end up getting a lot of money from it, you know, we designed it with that program in mind.
So there are things that the government could do to incentivize local and state education systems to do what they want. But are there lessons to be learned from what happened in New Orleans on the good side, first of all?
Well, sure. I mean, I think what charter advocates take away from the whole New Orleans experience is that just giving schools the autonomy to experiment and make their own decisions about curriculum and hiring and all of that can lead to better outcomes than a traditional district where it's all being decided from a central office. When you free people up who are in a position to you know, who are in the building every day with the kids, things can improve.
Where has the system fallen short in New Orleans?
Yeah, so obviously it's come with a lot of criticism and a lot of controversy. The biggest drawback that has gotten the most attention is the plight of students with special needs. And that can range from anything to, you know, students that just need speech therapy to students who are, you know, severely autistic and need a lot of, you know, intensive interventions. Years ago, before New Orleans instituted a central enrollment system, the charters just did their own enrollment, and there were questions about whether or not every school was taking their fair share of students with special needs, or, you know, kind of suggesting to certain families that maybe they should go to a different school because taking care of special needs can be really expensive. And so the worry was kids were just kind of getting bounced from building to building, and there was evidence of that. There was a big lawsuit filed by the Southern Poverty Law Center. It resulted in a consent decree, a sort of court-ordered reform plan that requires stepped-up oversight on the part of the state. And now there is actually a central enrollment system where parents sort of rank their top choice of school, and they're assigned to a campus based on a computer algorithm. So there's been some missteps and some stumbling and some trying to figure out how to make the system not just produce better test scores, but be, you know, fair and equitable.
That's Andrew Vanacore, who is deputy editor at the New Orleans Advocate, and we'll link you to his article about New Orleans and charter schools at hereandnow.org. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, to Key West, Florida now, where people have been following one guy's every move, and he's been dead for 150 years. Nancy Klingener from Here and Now contributor WLRN explains.
While he was trying cases as a U.S. attorney, William Hackley was not impressed with the juries of Key West. He wrote these observations in his diary in 1830.
The greater part of the persons who call themselves householders, being drunken and vagabond sailors, who have built themselves palmetto huts on the quays, and who are usually drunk from the time of their arrival on the quay until their departure, or all their money is gone.
Hackley was trying a man for keeping a disorderly house, and he wasn't sure the jury was entirely sober. Hackley's opinions and observations have become part of the current conversation in Key West, because all year the local paper, the Key West Citizen, has been running entries from his diary from the year 1855.
I look for it every morning.
Leonard Salazar is part of a group of longtime locals who gather at a strip mall cafe every morning. Usually they talk about current events, like Medicare changes and road improvements. But now the daily events of 1855 are in the mix, too. Salazar is intrigued by the language from Hackley's diary.
A lot of the words he uses to describe medical conditions and locations and other things. Plus, I'm always looking to see what's going to happen next to him.
It was Tom Hambright's idea to run the Hackley Diary in The Citizen. He's the historian at the Monroe County Public Library. Hambright realized pretty quickly he had a hit on his hands.
People started stopping me in the grocery store asking me about him.
What about the babe? The poor, sick babe.
Fran Decker's been a Hackley fan from the beginning. She likes reading about Hackley growing hemp and his work as a lawyer. But it's the entries about the babe that really get her.
The babe had no fever during the night, nor this morning, but she did not sleep well, and her mouth is filled with white blisters or ulcers. We cannot examine them well, and her tongue is coated with a thick white fur.
Tom Hambright gets a lot of questions about the babe, but he has a no-spoilers policy.
I say, no, it's a serial. You got to stay tuned. Yeah.
Hambright started running the diary entries as a way to change up the Today in Key's History column in the paper. He's been writing it for almost 20 years.
So it was getting a little boring because history doesn't change. The railroad's always going to be here on January 22nd, 1912. So I was getting bored doing it.
Hackley's diary offers detailed descriptions of life in Key West in the 1800s. He notes the daily temperature, which has led to local debates about whether the climate has changed since then. Librarian Ann Leighton Rice saw the diary's reach reverberate through social media after one of the entries had a typo.
Took a shower bath, the well having dead mica in it and smells bad.
So Rice posted on Facebook.
Typo, not dead mica, dead mice.
Just the correction, without any reference to Hackley, the diary, or the newspaper column.
Universally, people understood what I meant. And I got so many people that click like or commenting saying, oh, yeah, now I know what that means. Okay, thought so.
Fran Decker says it's gotten to the point where she starts every day reading William Hackley's diary.
My only regret is I wish he'd write more.
It isn't just about the past. The diary also makes Decker think about the future.
I'm a lifelong journaler myself. I've been keeping diaries since I was 7, and it makes me think, what if somebody 150 years from now reads it? They don't care that I went to the gym, but they might want to know what I had for dinner.
Key West citizen readers get to follow William Hackley's life for one more year. He continued the diary through 1856 before leaving the island for Joliet, Illinois. For Here and Now, I'm Nancy Klingener.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
Millions of people are without power in the Midwest and Great Plains today following a winter storm that has brought freezing rain, sleet, and lots of ice. At least 6 deaths have been blamed on the storm so far. Kansas has been hit hard, especially by the ice storm. Here's reporter Morgan Radford in Wichita.
In Kansas, 200 National Guard troops at the ready as crews salted icy roads that already caused a 20-car pileup.
Yeah, be careful, guys.
Putting residents.
When all is said and done, it may be said that the storm's epicenter was the small town of Beaver, Oklahoma, a one-mile town with a population of around 1,500. I spoke with John Elfers, the fire chief there. He said the town has up to an inch of ice and is reeling from the storm. I asked him to describe what it looks like there today.
More or less a war zone. All of the trees are pretty well stripped. We've got power lines sagging all throughout town. The town is still without power. Everybody's yards are full of tree limbs of probably anywhere from, 2 inch to 6, 8 inch, 12 inch.
Have you ever seen a storm like this before?
Not here in this town.
So what are you advising the residents of Beaver to do?
The elderly, once we can get to them, if they need to be transported to the hospital for heat or oxygen, or we've also got emergency housing from our churches, and if they don't want to go anywhere but to there, we are trying to get them to heat and food.
How long do you think it's going to take to clean up after this storm?
Yeah, I'm going to say probably a week, 10 days, possibly 2 weeks.
That's John Elfers, the fire chief in Beaver, Oklahoma. I also spoke with police officer Travis Snowden, who's been answering calls and helping people get to safety.
We've
we've had people call in from anywhere, lines going across their houses to we had one incident where the tree limbs pulled the power line away from the house, which caused the meter box to spark, causing a small fire outside the residence. Just things like that.
Do you have power lines just down all over the place right now?
Yes, sir, we do.
And how do you make sure that people are safe, that, you know, kids don't walk over and touch them or anything?
If need be, we keep them between 80 to 100 feet away. And if more precautions necessary, we've been closing off roads.
Well, on top of that inch of ice, it's been snowing in Beaver, Oklahoma, and other parts of the Great Plains. The weather is supposed to warm up a bit in the next day or two and turn to rain. Beaver officials are hoping that'll give them some time to clean up downed trees and power lines. And as for the storm, it is not over yet. It is expected to move north and east, heading to Rochester, New York, and Springfield, Massachusetts tomorrow.
As we mark Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the first African-American president is leaving office. When Obama was first inaugurated, it was seen, as writer Jelani Cobb said, as a kind of moral momentum, King's life and his promise of a dream fulfilled. But we enter this week with President-elect Donald Trump tweeting insults at a man who walked with King, Congressman John Lewis. Lewis called Trump's presidency illegitimate because of Russian interference. Trump blasted back on Twitter that Lewis's district was crime-infested, which people who live in the thriving city of Atlanta saw as racist. So where are we on King's dream? Before that exchange, Peniel Joseph, the African-American historian and professor of public affairs at the University of Texas, wrote in Newsweek that triple threats to humanity, racism, militarism, and materialism that King cited near the end of his life have increased, not diminished. Peniel joins us now. And Professor Joseph, Donald Trump's supporters would say this current ugliness comes from John Lewis calling a presidency illegitimate. Your thoughts?
I think it's part of a larger disturbing pattern in terms of Donald Trump's view and relationship with the African-American community. Going back to his father, who's the entrepreneur and real estate developer, Fred Trump, there were accusations and allegations of discrimination in their real estate empire. And they had to basically settle with the Justice Department after a series of lawsuits in the mid-1970s. So I think that Donald Trump himself views African-Americans with distrust and really relegates all of us, irrespective of social economic class, because there's a thriving black upper middle class, relegates all of us to being in these ghettos and what he calls inner cities.
You know, people in Atlanta, the district, John Lewis's district, are saying, well, wait a second, we have Coca-Cola, we have CNN, we have a thriving upper and middle class black population.
Trump's notion of Chicago as a metaphor for the inner city and that African Americans are just killing each other, it really sells well to his own constituency, but it's not reality. We have a multiracial, multi-class, even within the black community, public sphere that's actually thriving. Not everybody is marginalized. Not everybody is incarcerated. So we face institutional racism, but we don't all face it in the same manner.
Well, you mentioned the 1973 Justice Department lawsuit against Trump management, which he was president of. They were accused of violating the Fair Housing Act, which was passed partly in tribute to Martin Luther King and his work. So it seems as if a lot of paths go to King, even from present day. But the title of your piece in Newsweek is The Martin Luther King That America and Obama Ignore. So you are holding President Obama accountable as well. Let's explain that. The piece starts with a reference to President Obama's final State of the Union address last January. Let's listen to the section where Obama is appealing to all Americans to add their voices to the public debate.
Voices that help us see ourselves not first and foremost as black or white or Asian or Latino, not as gay or straight, immigrant or native born, not Democrat or Republican, but as Americans first, bound by a common creed. Voices Dr. King believed would have the final word. Voices of unarmed truth and unconditional love.
What's wrong with that?
No, there's nothing wrong with that. This has to do with my criticism of Obama has to do with really his policies and not going far enough. Because what King offers us is a real searing critique of the flaws and shortcomings within American democracy. But he also asks all of us to look at ourselves and see how we're participating in these machines of materialism and militarism and racism. And I think Obama, he's done great speeches, but I think in a policy sense, at times he has not gone far enough, whether it's we think about the criminal justice system, mass incarceration, whether we think about talking about poverty. King dies in Memphis, Tennessee. He's assassinated helping sanitation workers who are on strike. Obama's had to be much more of a pragmatic politician than the kind of crusader for truth and justice and love that King was during his lifetime.
Well, one's the leader of a whole country. One was an activist. I mean, is that putting too much of a burden on Barack Obama? There's been a lot of writing about this that, you know, he wrestled with how much can I talk about the black population as issues like Trayvon Martin came up, the young man killed in Florida, when I have to represent all people.
Well, you know, I think he's had it both ways. On one level, he adopted the mantle of King for many voters. On the other side, he says he's president of all people. So I think when it comes to King's legacy, you have to embrace the entire legacy. I think what we are more comfortable with, Robin, is picking and choosing and saying, well, we agree with nonviolence. And then we stop short when King talks about economic redistribution. The greatness of King's legacy is that the ideas, they transcend presidents and election cycles, and they force us to confront this idea of the beloved community, and this community that abandons war, that abandons violence, that abandons materialism in favor of a real love ethic, which King said was connected to public policy and legislation and legal breakthroughs, but transcended those because we were going to change minds and hearts at the same time.
Well, we've talked about this before, the fact that there's the early King who primarily focused on civil rights and was the, if I may, the good black that people could put their arms around because he was for nonviolence. But towards the end of his life, he was embracing things like some of the black power protests that were led by Stokely Carmichael. He still rejected violence, but he was embracing, as you write, a more dynamic militancy and impatience of the younger activists. And here he is speaking out against the Vietnam War in his 1967 speech at Riverside Church in New York.
Life and history give eloquent testimony to the fact conflicts are never resolved without trustful give and take on both sides. Tonight, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi and the National Liberation Front, but rather to my fellow Americans.
Peniel Joseph, talk more about this King that you feel people are less, leaders are less comfortable with.
Yeah, this is the King who's really speaking truth to power. So this is a King who's being rejected by Newsweek, who's being rejected by Time Magazine, the New York Times. They say he shouldn't mix civil rights and Vietnam. And it is a King who never embraces violence, but actually understands and embraces aspects of the Black Power movement's radical critique of liberal democratic capitalism in the United States. So this is a King who's really a champion for poor people, economic justice, multiracial, multicultural democracy, but who, even as he's still singing We Shall Overcome, the public's response is going to be much more reticent. Mm. The political response is going to be much more reticent. And really, when we think about the civic response until his assassination, is much more reticent. This is a King who's really a nonviolent revolutionary that makes the American public much more uncomfortable than the King at the March on Washington.
Well, and am I reading correctly that you are drawing a line here? You're saying that as King embraced some of this more dynamic militancy, you'd like to see America and Obama embrace Black Lives Matter.
No, absolutely. And I think that that is absolutely in that Kingian tradition of that love ethic. And for King, justice was what love looked like in public. And so when we think about the Black Lives Matter movement and really all these different social movements that have been coming out in Standing Rock and in other places, these are movements about radical humanism. And that's King's philosophy. Just because you put the word black in front of Lives Matter, it doesn't make it less universal. It makes it more universal. And in this case, you just get to the universal through the particular.
Let's think about that for a second. Get to the universal through the particular. When Black Lives Matter, all lives matter.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think what King teaches us and reminds us when he talks about the great wells of democracy from the letter from the Birmingham jail is that the United States, this democracy is something that's always living, growing, and breathing. And he envisioned a more expansive democracy than the founders had ever conceived or imagined. And I think that's the greatness of King, that he saw greatness within the country, but he was willing to say that we all had to work for it. And he was willing to call out the country's shortcomings, even though it's a country that he loved enough to die for and give his life for to transform it.
That's Peniel Joseph, professor of public affairs at the University of Texas, reflecting on this Martin Luther King Day. Peniel, Professor Joseph, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
Tomorrow, the 47th annual World Economic Forum gets underway in Davos, Switzerland. It's a gathering where the rich and powerful make deals and talk about the global economy. But this year, with the election of Donald Trump and the vote for Brexit in the UK, will the conversation be different? Joining us now is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jamie.
And I think it's fair to say that this group of people gathering in Davos is pretty pro-free trade, pro-globalization. So with what we've seen in the last year, with Trump's election, with Brexit, they've made the theme of Davos this year responsive and responsible leadership. Is that a response to what's happened?
Responsive is a great euphemism for what a lot of these people must be feeling, which is, oh my God, what is happening in the world? Davos represents, you know, the few, the rich, the elite plotting the future of the planet. But it turns out that the planet's future is actually plotted by the will of the many. And in the U.S. and to a certain extent in the U.K. and across Europe, it is the non-rich, non-elite many who have delivered several crushing blows to the Davos way of thinking, which, as you said, emphasizes free trade and a kind of globalized prosperity. But the movement among the developed world seems to be less open, more protective, more let's take care of ourselves first. And this sort of runs antithetical to the Davos strain.
And we should point out, as Andrew Ross Sorkin does in the New York Times today, that Donald Trump has never been invited to the gathering at Davos. But do you think that the people who are there, because of what's happened, are likely to change their own views on globalization and free trade or simply try to convince the winners that they should follow them instead?
I think you're going to see a lot of triangulation. I think you're going to see a lot of people saying, you know, this is what we said. This is the idea that we predicted would take over the future of the world. And clearly it is not taking over the present of the world. Trump has been advancing, though, an argument that's probably most familiar to some economists from the left when it comes to trade. Economists who have said that globalization has all sorts of negative side effects for local communities that are exposed to Chinese and Mexican trade, that it's bad for the U.S. to run a persistent trade deficit and all these ideas. And so I think that, you know, what Trump has done in many ways is scrambled the ideological map and made it very confusing to pin him down. And so I anticipate that because Davos is populated not only by, you know, not just academic thinkers, but also practitioners and people who actually make policy, that they're going to try to chart a central course and say, how can we adjust given the realities of the last 12 months?
And they'll do that while sipping on a delicious hot cocoa in the mountains of Switzerland. Derek, I want to ask you about something else. There's a new Harvard study out on the American dream and specifically how many people in the U.S. believe that the American dream is real, that you can climb the economic ladder no matter who you are. What did researchers find?
Two findings. First, that Americans are extremely optimistic about social mobility, the ability of poor Americans to climb that economic ladder. Europeans are much more pessimistic. The second main finding is that attitudes predict policies. If you're pessimistic that poor people can get rich on their own, you tend to think, well, we should give them welfare. We should give them subsidies. We should help them out. They need our help. Whereas if you think that poor people can get rich on their own without government help, then you say, well, there's no need to help them. Let's just make sure the government stays out of the way. And the natural state of economic affairs is one of extreme social fluidity. And it's interesting to talk about social mobility in the same segment as Davos,
right?
Because if you ask people in Davos, do you want the poor to have a better shot at getting ahead? I presume assume most of them will say yes. Who says no to that? But social mobility implies fluidity between the classes. If the poor get rich, yes, but also the rich aren't guaranteed their wealth. The rich can get poor too. And I'm not sure that financiers are across Switzerland sipping that hot cocoa are going to want to promote policies that could impoverish themselves and their families.
Well, how do the perceptions of the American dream break down in this country between liberals and conservatives? Are they different?
There's a huge difference. Left-wing respondents, liberals, are more likely to support more distribution, more welfare, when they hear how bad social mobility is. Essentially, they see social mobility, bad social mobility, as a sickness for which welfare is a medicine. Conservatives, however, tend to believe, in the modified words of Ronald Reagan, that not only is government something that cannot fix the problem, government is the problem. And so no matter how bad you describe social mobility to right-wingers in the U.S., this study found, they still won't support more government help for the poor.
And the people who are the most optimistic about climbing the ladder, these researchers found, live in the areas with the least economic mobility.
Right. It's very interesting. I think this is the crux of it. You have these pockets of the U.S. that have long histories of segregation and states' rights advocacy and resistance to government welfare assistance that goes back decades. And possibly because the traditions of welfare and public investment in schools and neighborhoods is low in these areas, social mobility there is not great. But ironically, it may be precisely the belief that social mobility is possible if you just take away government help that is contributing to their plight, that essentially the American dream in some parts of America is eating itself. And it is this quasi-religious faith that, of course, the poor can just naturally work their way up to become rich that keeps many Americans from supporting the kind of welfare policies that actually makes social mobility most possible for the low income.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. We'll link you to that study at hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.